Lecture 8, Buddhist Art and Architecture.
If I asked many of you how you first came in contact with Buddhism and how you began to develop some kind of an impression of the tradition, I suspect that for many of you, your first contact with this great, formidable religious tradition that we're discussing in these lectures would be through Buddhist art. Oftentimes, I see in the offices of people who are not particularly religious and don't know very much even about the Buddhist tradition or about Asian civilization, little images of the Buddha, sometimes the fat little images that you see from China, sometimes the more rarefied and more elegant images that come from India. Whatever kind they are, they often seem to express to people, even if they don't know very much about Buddhism, something that's important about this religious tradition and are, for that reason, I suppose, an object that would be attractive to put on your desk or in your apartment or in your room. So our job, it seems to me, as we work our way through many of the different kinds of historical expressions of the Buddhist tradition and of Buddhist values, would be to comment a bit on this development, this tradition of Buddhist art, so that we can understand how Buddhists have expressed the Buddha through visual media, how these images have functioned in Buddhist life, and understand something about some of the different types of images so that we can begin to recognize them when we encounter them in museums or in the apartments or offices of friends or associates. Now, if we look back historically, the very earliest representations of the Buddha in the Buddhist tradition, we find not statues or images of the Buddha, but what I think you would have to call shrines. It is holy places that are connected in one way or another with the presence of the Buddha. The Pali word for a shrine is chaitya. The Sanskrit word is chaitya, and it means simply a holy place that's associated in one way or another with this powerful and influential figure. The earliest of these shrines contained relics of the Buddha's cremation, and later ones were associated in one way or another with events or objects that were connected with the Buddha's life. Now, in the early shrines, the ones that were established, we imagine, shortly after the death of the Buddha, the relics of the Buddha's cremation were taken to funerary mounds, big, solid, round mounds that had a square structure on the top and then a series of parasols that extended up from the top of that square structure. The relic of the Buddha's cremation was put inside that square structure at the top of the mound. And then around the mound, very often, not in every case, but very often, there was a railing that seemed to delimit this space as a sacred space. Now, as time went on, the relics of the original cremation of the Buddha were taken out, according to Buddhist tradition, and redivided and further distributed. So what was originally a set of only about six different holy places became a vast profusion of places associated in one way or another with the relics that lingered from the Buddha's cremation. But this wasn't the only option. There also were objects that the Buddha owned in one way or another. I mentioned in a previous lecture that important shrine of the Buddha's begging bowl in Peshawar up on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. There were other shrines like that, too, in the early centuries after the Buddha's death, associated with objects that he that were part of his life. And a common form of shrine, similar to these shrines of the Buddha's relics and also of the Buddha's possessions, is the shrine associated with the Buddha's footprints. You can imagine, once the storytelling capacity of this early community began to elaborate itself, that you could find footprints just about anywhere, in the ripples, in the stones, on the bed of a stream, in the indentation in the rock, on the top of a mountain. And all sorts of stories could be spun out to explain how the Buddha might have traveled through that spot or landed there and making some remarkable visit to the heavens or whatever it was. So Buddha's footprints are found very commonly in the Buddhist world and function as shrines in this early sense. How did they work in Buddhist devotion? Well, one of the things that these shrines made possible was the early Buddhist tradition of pilgrimage. Some of the early reliquary mounds were set up in places that were associated with particularly important events in the Buddha's life, like the great reliquary mound at Sarnath near the deer park where the Buddha gave his first sermon. There also are other reliquary mounds associated with other places that were important in the lifetime of the Buddha. People went around to these pilgrimage spots, paid them homage, venerated the memory of the Buddha in these places, and also at the same time visited many other important shrines that are connected to these larger shrines. I sometimes think that the tradition of the biography of the Buddha is, which grew up rather late in Buddhist history, is really a collection of the great stories that began to elaborate themselves at all of these pilgrimage places in northern India that were associated in one way or another with events in the Buddha's life. Now, when you visited a pilgrimage site like this or came into the presence of one of these shrines associated with the Buddha in some fashion, you engaged in what we would call an action of worship. It's important, I think, for us as observers, students of the Buddhist tradition, to be aware to some degree of the vocabulary of Buddhist worship, how you would actually go about worshiping at a Buddhist shrine. The Indian word for worship is puja, and in many respects, Buddhist worship is very similar to the worship you would find of an image in the Hindu tradition, or for that matter, in Sikhism or in Jainism or one of the other religious traditions of India. You make offerings to the image, fruit, flowers, incense, very often, sometimes a flame, a candle. In Southeast Asia, one of the most important things you can do for many images is to take in just a little bit of gold leaf and add it to the image. The images themselves are already gilded in many cases, but you can go in and simply add another layer to the gilding of the image. It's a way of making an offering to the image and, in a sense, worshiping it in the classic vocabulary of Indian worship. Another thing it's important to do at an image is simply to see it. This is where the worship of an image begins to cross the line for us into the aesthetic contemplation of an image. In classical Indian worship, one of the things that you do is, as we say in English, to take the darshan of an image. The word darshan means simply to see. You go to the image, you look at it. Very often, its eyes are quite striking, and you get the sensation that it's looking at you, and some important emotional connection is established by this visual relationship between you and the image. If you ever get a chance to travel in India, one of the things that you might do to open yourself up to this way of relating to an Indian image would be to go to a Hindu shrine. It's difficult to do this at Buddhist shrines, at least in India these days, because there are very few of them that are active and actively in operation. But to go to a Hindu shrine at the beginning of the worship process. Often, the image sits in an enclosed area right in the center of the temple, and there's a curtain over the place where the image, the central image, resides. And in that enclosed area, there would be a group of Brahmins performing some rituals. And as you come up, you don't know very much about it. It looks a little mysterious, and you hear some drumming and some chanting, and you can smell the smell of incense beginning to waft out of the Holy of Holies in the center of the temple. And then, at least as I've experienced it in a few Hindu temples, there's a moment when all of a sudden there's a burst of drumming, sometimes with a little dumaru drum, tick, 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 boom, 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 and the bell rings, and somebody pulls the curtain aside, and there, staring at you, is this remarkable image. And you really feel the hair stand up on the back of your neck. You feel like you are, in some visual sense, face to face with some kind of manifestation of ultimate reality. It's a very strong experience of vision, and it's not quite comparable to anything that I can think of in Western religious traditions that might be closer to home for many of you. Perhaps a good example might be the Greek Orthodox worship of icons, where the visual connection with the image is really the central thing. It's not simply that you're contemplating a vision of a saint in some aesthetic sense. You're looking through the icon as a mirror or as a window into ultimate reality. There's an element of that that takes place in the Hindu and Buddhist traditions. It's part of the Buddhist contemplation of an image. Now, when lay people go to an image and make offerings to it, or for that matter, take the darshan of the image, their principal goal would be to make merit, that is, to perform good karma, to accumulate good karma, so it'd be possible for them to have a better rebirth in a future life. And often, when you see the way Buddhist images are used in our world, it is clear that something like this is going on. There's a Thai restaurant in our neighborhood at Boston University, for example, just up Commonwealth Avenue from the classroom building where I normally teach. It's a charming, delightful, but fairly typical Thai restaurant. And in the back of the restaurant, there's a small altar with an image of the Buddha, and flowers and incense and so on have been placed there. My sense, even though I've never talked to the owners of the restaurant about why it's placed in there in the restaurant as it is that, of course, it's a gesture of respect to the Buddha, but it also, quite seriously, is a way of invoking the Buddha's aid, making an offering to the Buddha, to invoke in some way the power of the Buddha to prosper in the business of serving Thai cuisine to the inhabitants of Commonwealth Avenue. So the vocabulary of worship is connected with prosperity and good luck, not merely with the pursuit of nirvana. Strictly speaking, though, a monk or a nun would not use the shrines in this way. They would use the shrines as a focus of meditation, to be reminded of the Buddha's teaching in order to prosper themselves on the way to nirvana, to pursue nirvana and be reminded of the things that they need to do in their own meditation and in their own practice to achieve nirvana as the Buddha did in his own experience. So the distinction between the layperson's use of an image and the monk or nun's use of an image is like the distinction between the form body and the Dharma body. The layperson worships the form body to get good karma, to get merit. The monk or nun meditate on the image or on the shrine in order to understand the Buddha's Dharma and appropriate it in their own experience. But actually, the practice of lay people and monks or nuns is more complicated than that and doesn't fall so easily into such a simple distinction, because the lay people often use the shrine clearly to meditate on the Buddha's teaching. It's not just a way of gaining merit, but it's a way of reminding themselves of what the Buddha teaches them about their own life. I remember reading a story about a Thai businessman in Bangkok who was wearing a particular image of the Buddha around his neck, and somebody asked him why he did that, and he said, well, of course, it's good luck. It brings me prosperity in my business. But when he was pressed, somebody asked him, well, how does it bring prosperity to you? The man said, well, it's because it reminds me that I should observe the five precepts and by observing the five precepts, I can follow the example of the Buddha, and that will help me prosper in this life. So the image teaches him something about the Buddha Dharma while he also pays homage to it as an image. And I think it's also true to say historically and practically speaking that monks or nuns are not at all averse to gaining merit in certain kinds of situations. And one obvious reason for this is that not all monks or nuns are going to achieve nirvana in this life. They're part of a long process that will lead perhaps to nirvana somewhere down the road, and so it's not totally inappropriate to act for the purposes of merit-making in their ordinary, the ordinary flow of life, even though it's not a part, you might say, of the vocabulary of monastic practice. Now, another question you might ask about these shrines, which we're really treating in a way as typical Buddhist objects of worship. Let's ask another question about it. Often is troubling to people who come from a Western culture and see Buddhists worshiping at an image or a shrine of the Buddha somewhere in the Buddhist world. In what sense do these images represent the Buddha? Is the Buddha present in that image? Is he there? Is the image the Buddha himself? Does the image in some way contain the power of the Buddha? For Hindus, the answer to this question would be relatively easy, because as part of Hindu worship, the deity is called in to become present in the image. So that you can say, I think quite appropriately in many Hindu settings, that when you worship an image of a god like Shiva or Krishna or Vishnu, that you are worshiping the Shiva or Krishna or Vishnu that is present in that image. But in a Buddhist case, strictly speaking, the Buddha has achieved nirvana and is no longer available, is no longer present in that image. So the image stands in a somewhat more complex and more sophisticated relationship to the Buddha himself. How does that relationship take place? Well, it's understood historically that when the Buddha died, he left behind in his relics and in the places that he touched and the objects that he used a certain power. It's called in Sanskrit adhisthana. I translate it as sustaining power. And it resides in that object in such a way that can make that object effective for you when you worship it. So to pay homage to something like the Buddha's begging bowl or to footprints that he left behind in the landscape of northern India allows you to plug in some way into the lingering power of the Buddha's presence in that place. The Buddha himself may be gone, but there's a power left that he has left behind that you can get access to by engaging in some act of worship. Now, this was made particularly clear to me in an episode that I once observed in the Dalai Lama's visit to Middlebury College in Vermont. The Dalai Lama was there, of course, like a great Buddhist saint, perhaps in some respects like the Buddha himself, and he was engaging in a worship service in the chapel. They said a lot of prayers and gave some sermons, and then the Dalai Lama got up from his throne and he walked out of the chapel and on down the hill to go and have lunch. There were a group of Tibetan devotees of the Dalai Lama there. It was a small gathering. They probably could easily have gone up to the Dalai Lama and asked him for a blessing or asked him for some teaching. But instead, I was really struck by this. Instead, they waited until he left and went into the chapel and placed flowers on the empty chair where the Dalai Lama had been sitting. It occurred to me that what they were doing at that moment was a lot like the basic vocabulary of Buddhist worship. The Buddha is gone. He's in nirvana. We can't get access to him. We can't invoke his aid, but he's left behind powerful places. where we can worship and we can get access in some way to the power that he has left behind. Now, you can ask one more thing, I suppose. How do you get access to it? In what sense are you touching the power of the Buddha in that place? Of course, on one level, it is physical power that's present. But on another important level for Buddhists always, it's a power that grows out of your own response to that object in that place. So it's a connection, you might say a meditative connection, that you make with that place that reminds you of the Buddha's presence. So all of that is meant to describe what I think is rather sophisticated and complex vocabulary of Buddhist worship. You don't just worship the Buddha in a particular shrine or an image. You get access to his power in a way that reminds you of the Dharma and helps you embody it to one degree or another in your own experience. Now, having said that about, as it were, the vocabulary of Buddhist worship and the establishment of a tradition of Buddhist shrine making and image making, what are the types of Buddhist images? What types of Buddhist images are out there for us to observe? Some of the earliest images are called aniconic images that represent the Buddha through symbols, places associated with his life, or sometimes simply by his absence. For example, we often see images of lay people bowing down in devotion to the Bodhi tree and to the empty throne of the Buddha's awakening. These images are quite common early in the Buddhist tradition, in the early centuries of the common era, at sites in Andhra Pradesh in south central India. These are found in many American museums. There's a great cache of these in the British Museum, and they may well be very familiar to you if you have studied some of the traditions of Buddhist art. You can see similar images on one of the most important early Buddhist monuments, the stupa at Sanchi. In both of these cases, the Buddha would be represented by a symbol or by a place that the Buddha once occupied but now is absent. There's a debate about the meaning of these images. Some scholars say that these images are evidence of a tradition that prohibited representation of the Buddha in physical form. Others say that they don't represent the Buddha, but represent shrines associated with the Buddha after his death. I'm somewhat sympathetic to the second argument because I think many Buddhist shrines do function as reminders of the Buddha's absence. But I think, if truth be told, if you look at the whole tradition of these so-called aniconic images, there are many images that clearly are meant to be representations of events in the Buddha's life. So the interpretation of these images is as yet, shall we say, uncertain, but they constitute for us an important category of early representation of the Buddha. Near the beginning of the Common Era, craftsmen began to create images of the Buddha's physical form, to image the Buddha as a physical human being. These images appeared in a number of distinctive sculptural styles, and I'd like to mention some of those sculptural styles to you so that you can recognize them when you see them in museums or you see them in the pages of books. One of the first is the so-called Mathura style, associated with the region of Mathura in the Ganges basin. Buddha images in the Mathura style often have a large and fleshy body, typical, I think, of an indigenous Indian way of expressing the form of a human body. One of the earliest of these images is a seated Buddha from Ishapur in Mathura that can be dated to the first century before the Common Era. That's a very early Buddha image. They weren't very common until after the beginning of the Common Era in other areas of India. This is a flat, stylized image. It seems in many respects to be extremely simple, almost as if it were a folk image, but it clearly is the source of a tradition of representing the Buddha in physical form that then evolved in more elaborate ways later. As in a Buddha image that is fairly commonly seen in Buddhist, in literature about Buddhist art, from Abhichatra in Uttar Pradesh, that shows a seated image of the Buddha with his hand up in a gesture of fearlessness, his hand up just above his shoulder, conveying fearlessness to his disciples, and a slight smile on his face, as if he were conveying also by the expression of his face a sense of fearlessness. This too is a rounded, fleshy figure that feels in some sense like a folk image, although it's somewhat more sophisticated, considerably more sophisticated really, than the image from Ishapur. And it shows a characteristic of Buddha images that I must say I'm always impressed by, even in the most simple type of image. It seems, like all Buddha images, to be very firmly grounded on the ground, firmly seated on its seat, so it's not going to be shaken or rocked from side to side. And yet there also is a sense of buoyancy in the image, as if it somehow floated. I think, to me, that's one of the most impressive aspects of the physical representations of the Buddha. It's stable, but also, in a sense, has a quality of buoyancy. Now, another style that you'll see quite commonly is a style associated with Gandhara, a region on the boundary between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Here, the Buddha images show the influence of Greek craftsmanship, because Alexander the Great, as you may know, when he invaded the Persian Empire and managed to travel all the way to the plains of northern India, left behind in Afghanistan a series of Hellenistic kingdoms that had Greek craftsmen who were enlisted to provide images of the Buddha. These images show Greek influence in the drapery of the robes, and in what I would call the muscular anatomical quality of the image itself. You're much more aware in a Gandharan image of the gracefulness and the strength of the Buddha as a physical being. You can see lots of different types of Gandharan images representing different stages in the Buddha's life. You often see images of the Buddha's victory over Mara, the tempter, or an image that's quite striking to me of the emaciated Buddha during that austere period before he had undertaken the middle path. Images of the Buddha's first sermon in the Gandharan style are often identifiable from deer that are listening to the Buddha's sermon and from a wheel that symbolizes the Buddha's teaching. And then you often see some quite striking images of the Buddha's parinirvana, of the reclining Buddha at the moment of his death. Now, the Mathura and Gandharan styles came together to create what became eventually the classic style of Buddhist art, we know as the Gupta style. It appeared in northern India during the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries of the Common Era. Buddha images in the Gupta style are more fluid, more graceful, and in a sense more abstract. The Buddha's body is more slender. The drapery on his robe is depicted often as a series of fine folds and seems almost to make a kind of transparent veil over the Buddha's body. And the expression on his face often is more delicate and refined. You can often see standing Buddhas in the Gandharan style, quite graceful and impressive figures, I'd have to say, coming from different sites in northern India, including Mathura. The greatest of the Gupta images of the Buddha is this image of the seated Buddha teaching in the Deer Park in Sarnath. Where else but in the Sarnath Museum in Sarnath itself. This image is one I suspect that many of you have seen, and as you look at it, I think you might well ask yourself, since it's an image of the Buddha at the moment of teaching, what it teaches to you, since that aspect of Buddhist sculpture is essential to the tradition itself. How does that image convey to you the message of the Buddha's Dharma? This period also produced the monumental Buddha images at Bamiyan in Afghanistan that were recently destroyed by the Taliban government in Afghanistan. So you see here, I think, not anything like a systematic or thorough account of Buddhist art. That would be difficult for us to do in the time we have, but just some indication of the different varieties of images and some indication also of the way these images have functioned in the life of Buddhists from this time to the present. We'll have more to say as time goes on about the tradition of Buddhist art in other aspects of, in other periods in Buddhist history, particularly when we come to the period of the Mahayana.